So, David Lang at Intuit, I've been there for almost 16 years now. Grew from a 30-person company to an 800-person company before we got bought by Intuit in 2007. And the division I'm in at Intuit does internet banking for just under 2,000 separate banks and credit unions. And as such, security and logging is something that comes up from time to time, shall we say. And so in 2000, in 2006, when this project started, we had the typical logging situation that evolves over time. Different people had done different things. Nothing was highly available. Nothing talked to each other. We had, you know, as a matter of acquisitions and so on, we had a very complex network, over 135 different subnets, over 100 pairs of firewalls connecting to those subnets, all of them proxies, so there were no routes between any networks, which is a double-edged sword. It means that your admins can't mess things up by missing a route, but it makes it harder to talk from place to place, which sometimes is a desirable thing. Our rate of growth was very, very high. For seven of the prior 10 years, we had doubled our size in any measure you wanted to say, server side, bandwidth, requests, logs, anything you wanted to look at. We had been growing very, very rapidly. Our current logs at the time, which we weren't gathering all of them by any means, we were estimating about 12,000 logs a second, including web server logs. And so when you look at, you know, what's this going to be in 3 years when you do a major project, that works out to the vicinity of 100,000 logs a second. And when you start talking about processing logs at that sort of rate, things get very interesting. And that's, you know, what this talk is about. We started off with formalizing the project here and got very ambitious about it. We said, you know, the goal for the project is to be able to gather any log that anything generates, whether it's an appliance, whether it's an application, anything. We needed to have an alerting engine that we could put rules in to alert us on all sorts of complex things and also simple things. And sometimes the simple things turn out to be the most important in a day-to-day operation. But you know, we have things ranging from you know, this machine logged out of disk space to other things that look for some, you know, this IP address is logging into more than 50 accounts on one site type of thing. We also need rapid ad hoc searching of the logs, and at this volume of log, that gets very non-trivial. Both for fraud investigations, where you're going through the question of, you know, so we got a report that this account had fraud on it at this time. Okay, who accessed it at that time? Who else accessed that account? You know, what else has this person accessed? So all sorts of things that you can't plan ahead of time of what you're looking for. Is very important for fraud investigations, and then for troubleshooting when things go wrong. You don't know what you're looking for ahead of time. For in the banking industry, we have requirements for very long log retention times, and when you start talking very large volumes of logs for a very long time, storage space and so on gets interesting. When you do know what you're looking for, you can generate periodic reports, daily reports, hourly reports on things, and so we needed that as well. And we wanted to make this be able to handle at least 3 years worth of growth without us having to re-architect anything. You know, add servers and so on if need be, yes, but re-architect, no. What we ended up doing was we ended up breaking the problem down into its various component steps and addressing each of them individually. You know, gathering the logs, transporting the logs, delivering the logs, and then analyzing the logs in several different ways. We ended up with an architecture there where we have a whole bunch of networks down there at the bottom sending their logs to a log relay that is attached to that network. Some of those log relay servers have 20 physical interfaces to hook up to different switches in order to be able to gather the logs. We also did that so that there was no chance of a firewall or a missing route or something like that preventing the logs from being gathered. We defined a name and a logging name, and that name maps to a local IP address on every single subnet, so people don't have to think, where am I, where should I send the logs? They just send it directly to that name. And then those machines send it on up the stack. For transporting the logs, we decided to go standards-based. We evaluated various different options and weren't happy with any of them solving all the problems, so we ended up building it out of the best of breed of the different components. Most of our existing logs that we were gathering at the time were syslog, and so we decided to start off with that as an option and see how far we could push it, switching to something else if needed, but start off with something straightforward. We looked at the various syslog options, sysklog that we were already running a modified version of, syslog-ng or rsyslog. We did some bake-offs and ended up selecting rsyslog. At the time that we started messing with it, it was able to do about 20 to 30,000 logs a second. By the time we finished messing with it and including some sponsored development on it, we were able to do up to 380,000 logs a second, which is basically giggy wire speed, and do that with UDP with no detectable packet loss. Our syslog also is extremely flexible in its capabilities and rule sets, and since we started this project, it has become the default syslog on all Linux systems. It's also supported on BSDs and Solaris. One of the things that we do as we're transporting the logs is that we sometimes need to fix the logs. For example, Cisco's, if you log by IP address on a Cisco, it logs timestamp IP tag message. If you log by name, it logs timestamp name space colon space tag and message. And so we have the relay boxes detect this, clean it up, and so that everything upstream matches up, and we don't have multiple formats to deal with upstream. For gathering the logs, sometimes you just point it at syslog server, and you're done. We have scripts that pipe output to logger. One of the actually most valuable things we did was an off-the-cuff idea someone had. Just vmstat 60 piped to logger. It gets you a log every minute from every server, and a surprising number of times when you need to go back and look for data, what happened on the server, what was the load like. Now you have an awfully dense information source available to you. Our syslog has the input module file there that you can point at files to slurp them in, including in recent versions the ability to combine multi-line files like Java dumps and so on, and just custom scripts. We have some that take binary formatted logs, reformat them into text, and spit them out to syslog. Delivering the logs is where things get real interesting. 100,000 logs a second, our system average of 250 bytes per log, and when you have four or more destinations for each log message, gigi wire speed is only 125 megabytes a second. And if you multiply that out, you find that we're getting very close to the theoretical wire speed just with four destinations. Let traffic go up a little bit, let you end up needing to go to additional destinations, and gig E starts to become the limiting factor. At the time we were starting this, 2006, 10 gig networks were, $5,000-$10,000 a port, and not something you could talk about for widespread use. Solution for this, though, turned out to be very interesting. We used multicast MAC, so this is multicast at the Ethernet layer, not at the IP layer. On Linux, in IP tables, it's called cluster IP. BSD has a similar feature. I've never used it, but I've when explaining how this works, people have spoken up and said, oh yeah, I've seen that. So multicast MAC is part of the Ethernet spec. It's not the IP multicast with the 224 IP addresses that you think of. It's completely transparent. Applications, firewalls, routers, they don't know you're doing multicast. They think you're just talking regular unicast traffic. You configure it in IP tables on your Linux boxes. It's designed for load balancing. What it does is you send out one copy of each of the packet to a special MAC address, and the Ethernet switch duplicates the packet and sends it out to all the different machines. And with the configuration in IP tables, you then make it so that only one machine actually processes the packet, even though multiple machines have received it. And the way you do it is with a IP tables command line, something like this, where you give it the IP address, the Ethernet, the MAC address. The key is in that first octet, the least significant bit needs to be one. And if so, then it's a multicast packet. You then tell it how many nodes there are in your cluster, in this case three, and which one you are, in this case one. And you tell it what parts of the packet you want to hash on. And then what it does is it hashes on the source IP, source port, in this case, and then it divides that into buckets. So for example, first packet here goes to bucket one, second packet goes to bucket two, third packet goes to bucket three. If you're box one of three, your application code will see that first packet, but not the other two. And so if you're a web server with this, web server one will see the request, service it, reply, and the other two won't see it, and just it gets dropped on the floor before it gets to the application. With connectionless protocols like UDP syslog, there's no reply back, so you can actually get away by having more than one machine receive and process a packet at a time. So you can configure two machines, for example, to receive all the packets with something like this, where you say the total number of nodes is one, and I'm machine one of one. And if you do that with two machines, now both machines receive the packet, but it's only been sent once by the relay boxes. This also works if one system is box one of four and another system is box one of one. So it means that your different clusters can be different sizes, and it's all completely transparent to the systems that are sending the traffic. At this point, you have the big pro that the speed limit is now the receiving port speed, not the sending port speed. And it doesn't matter how many different systems you are sending it to. You can add and remove clusters of machines receiving the traffic, and the senders don't have to know about it. And you can add and remove members of a cluster. And again, no other cluster and nobody who's sending things needs to care about it at all. The con is that it's UDP only. Log length, limited by packet size. Well, technically you can have larger packets and fragment them. That makes it more likely to cause problems with the second thing, which is UDP is technically unreliable. I say technically unreliable because in practice you can actually make it pretty reliable. in my benchmarks of our syslog, I was sending 380,000 logs a second over a commodity Cisco 3550 switch, 48-port 1U switch. And I would send messages, you know, a billion messages at a time at wire speed, and then count how many messages I received on the far side, and just loop through that test. And we ran it for weeks at a time with no packet loss in the lab. If you have other traffic on the switch for other things, you're more likely to have problems. If you have a lot of senders and multiple of them really start getting loud at the same time, you might have some problems depending on the size of your buffers in the switches. The biggest con in practice has been that it only works for Linux and BSD systems. So if you have proprietary appliances, you actually need to drop a Linux system in front of it to receive the message and then hand it off to the appliance. When we go to archive the log, or to analyze the logs, we have the four different issues, archiving, reporting, alerting, and searching. For archiving, we took the simple way of just having our syslog receive the messages. We rotate them once a minute and archive them off into a 16 terabyte disk array and deal with the issues when that 16 terabyte disk array fills up. We have, in order to make analysis easier, we have started to have our syslog split the common logs by subject type based on the syslog tags. And we just rotate them into year, month, day, type messages, hour, hour, minute, minute. Makes it pretty easy to go back and retrieve whatever logs we need to. For alerting, we started off with two different implementations. We had the usual build versus buy argument and couldn't settle it. So we did both. We bought Nitro Security commercial appliances, very expensive. I think we spent something like $700,000-$800,000 over the first couple of years in buying appliances. And we had all sorts of problems with them. They never could handle the load, and they couldn't handle syslog relays. They were regex based engines, and in order to simplify their tasks, they said, well, the first time I see traffic coming from an IP address, I'm going to figure out what type of machine it is and only apply the regexes that apply to that machine. So if the first log that came in was a Cisco log, it said, this is a Cisco box, I'm only going to apply Cisco regexes. Well, if it's a relay box, it is relaying for Linux, for Cisco, for Windows, and everything else, that tends not to work very well. They strung us along for a couple of years, promising to fix that in the next release, and we finally gave up on them. But while we were going that approach, those of us who were on the build side of things said, well, you're spending all that money, buy a couple of high-end $10,000 servers and let us experiment with the open source route. And so we went with Simple Event Correlator on there. That's a Perl-based script that is very, very powerful in terms of its alerting capabilities. In many ways, it turned out to be more flexible and more powerful than what Nitro did. It has worked very well on us. The one limitation it has is that it's single-threaded. With modern systems, there's a severe limit on how much you can do. In 2010, there was a LISA paper on doing log correlation, and that basically has become our roadmap for when we need to expand out the server. This is the route we go. Basically, what you do is you split the logs to a given type for a given machine, have it look at anything related to that type. And when it sees something, it generates a new log message, feeds it back into the system, and another correlation instance then looks for these I found something messages and can generate your alerts from there. And that, so far we haven't needed to do that. We've been able to split it into just multiple threads, and we haven't had a lot of need to alert on things from the different threads. That's taken a little bit of juggling, but not a lot. But that's the route to go when you need to expand out from there. For reporting, we've gone heavily with Ranum's artificial ignorance. Basically, filter out but count messages that aren't interesting, because the number of times that something that's not interesting happens can be interesting. A benign error message that happens 50 times a minute is no problem. If it becomes 5,000 times a minute, something's changed that you care about. Split the logs that you do know what they are off to separate scripts to summarize them. And frequently those scripts perform a mini version of this, where, like the Cisco analysis script reports on a bunch of Cisco stuff, and then anything that it doesn't recognize, it generates a summary report. And then take the remaining messages that you haven't stripped out and identified. You don't know that they're not interesting. You don't know what they are. Filter out minor differences and just summarize them by what is the most common message you have. We have this report each hour on that hour's log and each day on the day's log. And even with very high log volumes, this tends to shrink down and produce a small report, because the vast majority of your logs get filtered out in those first two steps. As the reporting scripts that we have, we currently run them on the archive server because it's got copies of all the logs, and they're whatever was convenient. We have things that are awk that came with tools that we use, Bash, Perl. The key thing that we found is that start with the simple brute force approach, rewrite when you find that performance needs it. Every couple of years, it starts to take 6 or 8 hours to process a day's worth of logs. That's the time to go back and optimize and rewrite things. This is a summary of my final summary command, filtering out things like port numbers, the PID from the syslog messages, a few common other messages and so on, and then just pipe it through sort unique C sort and dump the output to a file. For searching, we investigated SenseAge, Splunk, and Going Homebrew with GreenPlum, which is a Postgres derivative cluster database. SenseAge was very expensive. Every time we went back to them, the price the price tag went up. We budgeted for that amount the next year, and the price went up again. And it also has no front end. It's just the raw database. Splunk, very expensive, but it had a very nice front end, and their licensing is based on the amount of log volume you have, not the amount of hardware you throw at it. So whether you have one machine or 50 machines, the license cost from Splunk is the same. And with our retention history and so on, that was nice. GreenPlum was cheap, but didn't have a front end. And we decided that the need to write the front end was a problem, and so we ended up going with Splunk for searching. Initially, we did a by the book Splunk cluster, four indexer systems plus two forwarder systems. After a year of spitting logs into this, doing a single query over the entire thing could take up to 15 minutes. after testing a whole bunch of things, we re-architected Splunk. We eliminated the forwarders, having the indexers just receive the logs directly. And we went to basically a RAID 10 set of forwarders, where we have pairs of machines backing each other up, and then use the IP, the cluster IP, to distribute the load across. So the primary box, primary 1A is box 1 of 10. Backup 1A is box 1 of 10. And whichever, when they come time to roll their logs, they say, am I active or not? If I'm active, save it, send it to my backup. If I'm not active, I wasted my time, throw it away, and go on. Getting, we also upgraded the indexers significantly, but this brought the speed down to about 2 minutes for the search from 15. And when you're doing this sort of investigation, it's like get version control stuff. Speed becomes a feature in and of itself. When it's a 15-minute search, you think a long time about the search, you fire it off, you go get coffee, you go start working on something else. Search finishes in 15 minutes. At 20 to 30 minutes, you come back, and where was I? What was I searching about? What's the next thing I need to do? And it becomes a very slow loop. 2 minutes is the outer edge of you're still there, you still have the context in your mind, and so it's not just a factor of eight increase, it's more like a factor of 20 or 30 increase in productivity of the person doing the search. And so, as I described, we basically just set up pairs of machines backing each other up. About two months ago, Splunk finally came out with high availability features in the product, and so I'm investigating those to change this model over. So this is, you know, what we did in order to handle the very high log volumes, and it's a very modular approach, and it lets us plug in or unplug different analysis engines without disrupting the rest of it. You know, our syslog is our core infrastructure, but if our syslog development went off the rails, we could replace it by, you know, one of the other syslog implementations. And so we're not locked into any one vendor or product here. So. Any questions? Brent.
You mentioned sponsored development of SparkSyslog.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? How receptive were the developers to that? How receptive was management, your management, to funding that? You know, how did that all work?
Okay.
Because that's a model I think we haven't seen much of before.
Okay, so Brent was asking, the sponsored development, how did that work? How receptive were the developers, the management, and so on and so forth, and how did that work? So we actually sponsored several different things. One of the things was a rewrite to the core of our syslog, so that instead of handling a single message at a time in and out of its queue, it now handles batches of messages. This was started off by the interest of being able to insert multiple records into a database, but it turned out that just locking around the cube was a limiting factor. The R syslog developers were very receptive to this, and we ended up paying, I think it was $30,000 for all of the development work that we were doing, including having them write custom modules for some of our proprietary logs that we have. And the harder problem was management side. You know, we started this project when we were Digital Insight. We were then acquired by Intuit, and going from an 800 person company to an 8,000 person company adds a few layers of bureaucracy in purchasing. That was the biggest fight was getting the approval, even for what was really relatively small amounts of money. getting management to understand that, and getting the finance department to understand, no, this isn't work for hire where we own the code. This is open source code. That process took several months to go through. What we did was we have the logs come in. Our syslog writes them to the SSD, and then Splunk has its hot buckets that where it's rewriting things on the SSD, and then it rolls it out to the RAID array. Interesting thing we found is that when you have a almost read-only instance of a RAID array, which Splunk is, RAID 6 is just as fast as RAID 10, and gives you a whole lot more space to be able to have extra copies for stuff. The SSDs have been in use now for 5-6 years, and we have seen a few failures, but not a very large number of them. In practice, most of the writes end up being cached into RAM anyway, so we're not actually writing out to disk that often. Any other questions?
When doing this, do you encounter any nasty surprises or disappointments?
Did we run into any nasty surprises or disappointments? Not really. The biggest headaches were around the proprietary products and fighting with them. With the basic architecture and so on, we did a lot of testing in the lab ahead of time and things basically worked the way that we expected as we scaled up. We were pleasantly surprised to find how far we could end up scaling our syslog. Since the time that we did the testing at 380,000 logs a second, other people have reported using it up to 1 million logs a second. And so we have lots of headroom there. Anyone else? No, our data center, we did not have virtualization in place. For the syslog boxes, I'm interested in what happens with virtualization because especially with UDP syslog, if you get delayed too much, you can fall behind and start losing packets. With everything else, disk I/O starts to be a factor, and disk I/O is one of the areas that virtualization is not so good at. And so, you'd really have to do some testing. You should be able to make it work, but you might need more machines, more instances. Okay.